story off my website. I went to this director, and she said, I can't tell you who he is, but he's a major director in Hollywood. You know who this guy is. And said, it's story what Steven Spielberg told you. And he said, yes, it is. And then Steven Spielberg, this is a couple months ago, actually gets confronted with the story. He's asked about this story about Ronald Reagan, but they got it sort of messed up. Did Ronald Reagan get ushered out of the room after E.T.? And he said, no, what happened was Reagan stood up at the end of the presentation, and he said, this whole thing is real, as some of the people in this room will know. And he said it without a smile and without laughing. And to me, that would have ended it right there, that Ronald Reagan knew. And then Steven Spielberg killed the story by saying, I think he was joking. So if he hadn't said, I think he was joking, you would have had Steven Spielberg on the record saying that Ronald Reagan said E.T., the whole story of E.T. the extraterrestrial, was real. And here's the president, and that's basically why I went after the president, because if the president stands up and says this thing's for real, it's all over. And there's nobody that's going to say, well, the president really didn't have an authorization to say this. The president doesn't know what he's talking about. He's the top guy. Nobody can supersede what he says. If he says it's for real, it's for real. And that's why I always chase the presidents. But they're so carefully managed and so carefully controlled that unless you get them off guard, you aren't going to get anywhere, and nobody will do that. As I said, in these Republican primaries, nobody has asked a UFO question. Now, I asked it of Dick Cheney, and this was just after Bush got in 2001, in April of 2001. He was on a radio talk show in Washington, D.C., and the rumor had always been that Cheney was MJ-12. He knew what was going on. He was one of the key guys. And that's when I got on there and I said to him, Mr. Cheney, in all your jobs in government, have you ever been briefed on the subject of UFOs? And if so, when was it and what were you told? And he said, if I had been briefed on that subject, it would probably be classified and I wouldn't be talking about it. That would indicate quite strongly that if Cheney knew what it was, and it was classified, president has to know what it is, and it's classified, and he isn't going to talk about it either. So there's both ways you can say the president doesn't know, and you can write an article that says the president does know. It's still a toss-up to me, and I've got every piece of evidence. I've chased this for now 15 years, every little story, every little rumor about the president, to find out, does the president know? And I really, at this point, can say there's arguments on both sides of the question.
That's beautifully said. Very intriguing information, Grant. Now, I have two additional questions. We are about to go to a possibly 8-minute break. I'd love it if it could be reduced to maybe about 7 minutes there. And then also in the second hour segment, I very much want to discuss your two excellent books, UFOs, MJ-12 of the Government, and The Day the Aliens Fell to Earth, the story of the biggest UFO flap ever. That's a fascinating book. I hope I correctly gave the title there. Yes. We'll be right back at about 7 minutes. Grant, I can't wait to continue this interview.
Thanks.
Und sagt lieben Glauben Glauben.
Hello, everyone. Therese Sheridan, host of A Global Focus. Come at A Global Focus's new time, 9 to 11 p.m. Eastern. Come join the discussion.
Hi, this is Rob Simone, and I want to tell you about my brand new show here on the Paranormal Radio Network. Each week, I bring you the most interesting people on the planet, the most in-depth discussions, and the most controversial issues. We go where no talk show dares to go. Join me every week for the Rob Simone Talk Show here on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network.
Kevin Smith Show. Hi, this is Kevin Smith. Join me Monday through Friday right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Tune in to UFO Undercover, Wednesdays at 8 p.m. Eastern with your host, Joe Montaldo, right here on the Paranormal Radio Network.
Back to A Global Focus with our guest, Grant Cameron, author and field researcher and investigator. Grant Cameron's website can be found at www.presidentialufo.com. Welcome back, everyone, to our wonderful interview with Grant Cameron. Let me mute the room here. And the room, so I'm going to leave the room at the moment. I've got two questions here. Grant, can you hear me still?
Yes, I can.
Oh, thank you. And I'm sorry again, everyone, for that problem with my audio. I'm sure it's due to something I've done here. I'm asking these two questions because they may dovetail. First of all, our researcher from California, Rydell, is wondering as to the importance of John Podesta in politics. What influence does he have now in the government? And a related question would be from Angela Joyner. And she's wondering, what is your opinion of Leslie Kane's book, UFOs, Generals, Pilots, and Government Officials Go on the Record?
Okay, I'll start with Leslie Kane's book. I've read the book. The book is basically, my impression is the book is basically based on the disclosure witnesses. Leslie Kane used to work with Stephen Greer and split over whatever reasons. But I think the majority of the witnesses in the book are basic disclosure witnesses from the early 1990s. And my guess is that she wanted to do it to vet only the good witnesses, to put the best witnesses up. She's a professional reporter. She puts it all together very well, and her idea is to get the best witnesses, the best evidence, and to try to get the government to set up another agency like the French have to reinvestigate UFOs. So in terms of the book is great. The I have no problem with the evidence. Leslie and I have a sort of a difference in that final thing as to where do we go? What do we do with the evidence? Who do we go after? And I've just written an article that was put on my website yesterday, presidentialufo.com, where I deal with this specific thing. Leslie and a number of researchers are calling for a scientific investigation or a new congressional investigation. And they may be right. Everybody gets to do their sort of thing. Who knows who's going to be right? My impression is that neither of those is going to work. The congressional investigation is not going to work, and John Alexander, who almost got a congressional investigation, also warned, careful what you wish for, you may get it. And that is that if you get a congressional investigation, you may get a situation where they do another blue book thing and completely put the whole thing down and say it's absolute nonsense, the government shouldn't touch this, and really make it look bad. Just put this thing into the dark ages. Because congressmen want to be reelected. They don't want publicly to stand there and talk about UFOs. And in the one article I wrote where I talk about these different congressional chances that we had to get something happen, there was actually a situation where a congressional hearing actually started and it got sort of sidetracked and the UFO issue never came up. It actually went. So it's a very complex sort of thing that's really, I don't think, and the article I wrote, I put on my website yesterday, is UFOs a scientific dilemma, and saying that a scientific investigation, I totally disagree with. I think science is out to lunch on this thing. John Alexander points out quite accurately that if you take a look at science, 96% at the National Academy of Sciences, which is the highest level of science in the United States, there, only 4% of the National Academy of Sciences and scientists there believe in any sort of credence to UFOs, paranormal phenomena, any of that kind of stuff. So to think that suddenly we're going to get the scientists to take up this issue and run with it, I absolutely disagree with. I do not think that they are the credible people to deal with it because they're biased. They have their vested interest. They're working for government grants. They are not going to properly deal with this issue. And the proof of that is, if you take a look at all the scientists that we've come up against, whether it's Carl Sagan, whether it's Menzel, whether it's Bill Nye, the science guy, all the different people that have appeared on Larry King, all these different scientists, they are not the 10 worst scientists in the world that we just happen to get stuck with. Vast majority of scientists think like those people do. They don't look at the evidence. They ignore the evidence, the same as the OSTP did. They come up with conclusions that back their worldview. So in terms of the way Leslie and a number of researchers are pushing, I disagree that is going to work. Although my thing is to go after a congressman and a senator, use the political cover and pressure a certain issue to expose it. Maybe mine doesn't work either. This is my guess as to what's going to work, what's not going to work. But Leslie, I've known her for a number of years, and she's an excellent reporter, and what she's doing is trying to work from behind the scenes, getting inside the government and trying to get somebody inside the government to tell her, how do you maneuver this thing inside the government? I'm very suspicious of being inside the government because I think they're all a bunch of crooks, and I think they all have vested interests, and they couldn't care less about us. This is the last issue anybody in the federal government wants to touch. And so to me, I'm more into the Laura Johnstone thing. Let's put some pressure on. I think that all the major social and political movements of the 20th and 21st century have been done by pressure, whether it's women's right to vote, whether it's gay rights, whether it's AIDS, whether it's the civil rights movement. It was all tremendous pressure. things that the government didn't want to touch, didn't want to deal with, that they got pressured to deal with, and then once they got in there, then suddenly they switched sides and said, oh, we were always for gay rights, we were always, you know, trying to solve AIDS, and they changed. So I'm a pressure guy. I don't behind the scenes and trying to get these people, because I've looked at it, and I've looked at their vested interests, and I'm saying that it's not going to work. Now, this leads us to John Podesta. John Podesta was known in the Clinton administration. He was chief of staff to Bill Clinton, and he was known as the X-Files man in the Clinton White House. He was known, he actually phoned Area 51 at one point to ask them, after an X-Files episode, do you have UFOs there? And he actually phoned Area 51. He would never miss the X-Files. He would be at home, he'd watch the X-Files. Outside, he had his main office in his office. Going into the office, he had all sorts of X-Files paraphernalia. And so he is looked at as a real pro-UFO, we want the truth, and he is a Madison-type guy. He wants openness, he wants disclosure about all these issues, and he's written a number of papers. If you take a look at his background, I mean, he is in that scope of saying open, and he's gotten awards for it and stuff, and he's done it all the way through. This is not some sort of scam that he puts up and then takes down. When it comes to the UFO issue, he comes out when Leslie and the group is suing NASA. He stands up in front of the Sci-Fi News conference in 2002 and says, I think we should have disclosure. Now, basically, he's not talking about we want UFO disclosure, we just want openness on the records. We want you to open the records. We think there should be some truth to look at this issue. So then, not only is he the X-Files guy, now he's the guy who's actually stood up at the press room in Washington and said, we want openness, we want disclosure, we want the truth told about the UFO situation. So he has this positive thing. Now, what you got to remember, and that's what I say, is you got to see them the way they are and how it works. He is at 2002, Bush is in. So he's in the opposition party. And the same with Dan Burton. Dan Burton picked up the UFO issue and went after the Clintons because he hated the Clintons with a passion. So he took the UFO issue and he was going to drive it down the Clintons' throat, and as well as all the other scandals, he hated the Clintons. But Podesta in 2002 makes this positive pro-UFO statement, and then suddenly when Obama gets in, and suddenly now he's the guy who's advising Obama on who to bring into his cabinet, and he's the inside Washington guy who's telling Obama how things work and what he should do. So he's a very, very powerful guy, a right-hand guy to Barack Obama when Barack Obama comes in. So now he's in a situation where now it's your UFO cover-up. Now you're the dummy. You're the guy that's going to look real stupid if you bring up the UFO issue. And what does he advise Obama? Nothing. He doesn't touch the issue. It's not in Obama's platform with, and even Leslie went on the record when she was asked about this, that Obama's got better things to do than deal with this thing. He's a busy guy, he's got economy, he's got all this sort of stuff, and that's the reality of the situation. Is if suddenly it's your UFO cover-up, it's easy if the other party's in power for you to say, I want disclosure, I want the answer, but suddenly when you're in power, now, you're supposed to give the answers. Suddenly, it's you that's going to go to the firing squad if this thing all falls apart. And everybody gets cold feet, and they say, nobody's asking about it. We have this campaign going on right now. Nobody's asking about UFOs. It's not the end of the world. We drill a couple more oil wells. Let's leave the issue. It's not going to help us. And that's what Podesta has done. It's not an issue that's going to help. In fact, there's a guy who takes photographs, his name escapes me, in Washington, who got in contact with Podesta. He knew Podesta, got in contact with Podesta's right-hand man at George Washington University, and he had said, no agency is ever going to acknowledge this because you're stuck with it. And this is why I was so surprised when the White House actually made an official statement on this, because now the OSTP is the UFO organization. So, if, for example, if you're, say, Podesta, or you're, say, the justice guy or whatever, if you make a pro-UFO statement, suddenly all the UFO community looks and says, oh, it's injustice. That's where they're hiding. You end up owning the issue. And this is what Podesta's assistant guy, whoever he was, was talking about is that nobody wants to own the issue because it's not an issue that's going to get you anywhere. So if you're an advisor to the president, you're going to say, unless we have to deal with this, let's just stay clear of this. It's not going to get us anywhere. It is not politically expedient to do this. It's going to kill us. We want to look at the 10 things. If you take the polls, the 10 things, unemployment, the dollar, the European crisis. I mean, we know what it are, and we look at what are people going to vote on, what gets them to UFOs is not going to bring anybody to the polls. Jobs, all this other stuff. You want to get it reelected, let's stick to getting reelected, and you have what people don't realize, the power of these advisors that are around the president who tell him. And there's a prime example, Morris, he talks about this, when he went to the Rockefeller Ranch in 1995, where Rockefeller talked to them about UFOs. The reason that they went to the Rockefeller Ranch was because Dick Morris sent the Clintons to the Rockefeller Ranch. And the reason he did was because in 1995, people don't realize it, he had the scandals had started. He was in a lot of trouble. He was down in the polls, and they did. Morris was his advisor, and every guy who gets in has a powerful advisor, that whether it's Roe or all these different type of people, and he advised him that he had to go to the wilderness. Clintons used to go to the Hamptons and golf and sit with all the rich people and have cocktail parties and stuff. And Morris said, no, you can't, because we've done a poll. And in the 1996 election, the swing voters are going to be people who are into computers, who are into camping, who are into the outdoors. And that's why Bill Clinton went to Wyoming, to the Rockefeller Ranch, and he went skiing, and he went, camping. And Hillary was with him, and they were out in the wilderness because they were going after the swing voters in the 1996 election. And Dick Morris, if you read his book, said Clinton hated it. He was furious that he had to go to Wyoming instead of going and golfing with all his rich buddies in the Hamptons. And that's what I'm saying is, to understand the UFO thing, to fight it, the way I'm working it, is you find out what is actually going on behind the scenes. How do these people think, and how can you work it, putting yourself in their position? Because I've said numerous times that if I was in the government's position, which I'm not, and I had the UFO situation, I've written an article called The 64 Reasons Why They're Covering Up. If you take a look at the 64 reasons, if I was in the government and this was my thing, I'd be covering it up as well, because it would just kill you. There's actually reasons when you take a look at it and you see what is scaring the living daylights out of these guys. And the reason I looked at that whole thing is Jimmy Carter was adamant. So was Ford. They were adamant that they were going to get to the bottom of the UFO situation. They walked into the White House and they did nothing. And Ford, I don't really care, but Carter was the honest guy. He taught Sunday school since he was 18 years old. He was this guy. He was never going to tell a lie, and he was going to get this. What changed him? What did they tell him when he got in there that suddenly changed his mind and said, okay, I made a mistake. I'm not going to go after the UFO thing. You're right. We're going to cover this up. What causes these guys, and Bill Clinton supposedly was very interested in UFOs as well and was trying to get to the bottom of it, what causes them to sit on the sidelines and allow the cover-up to continue? There must be something that they're told, and that's why I spent so much time trying to see what are they thinking, how are they reacting. Don't think like we think. Think like they think if you want to try to beat them. And it works like that in sports. People will look at tapes. They try to figure out how the other team is thinking. That's how it works. And it used to work that way in political studies. My background is political studies, criminology. We used to, the cover-up used to be the Kremlin, the Soviet Union, and everybody was trying to figure out what was going on in the Soviet Union. And so it was a field called criminology. The Kremlin, and there was criminologists who would look at the Kremlin and try to figure out what was going on inside the Kremlin. And they weren't releasing anything, but you would look at things, for example, the some guy gets promoted to the Secretary of Agriculture, and a criminologist knew that he was about to get thrown out of the government because they had droughts every year, and if he made him the head of the agriculture, you could fire him because there was going to be a bad crop. And so there was all these type of things, is to figure out what's going on over and above what they're putting out. There's a secret going on. There's a government that's not telling you what's going on. And this criminology type thing where you try to get in and see what are they actually saying as opposed to what they're putting out.
Very intriguing response there. It does indeed. And, you know, I wanted to remind the audience of Greg's excellent website at www.presidentialufo.com. Also, his interesting articles there at the blogspot, White House UFO blog, whitehouseufo.blogspot.com. And his, I very much appreciate reading his articles, including that, the very recent one, UFOs, A Scientific Dilemma. And my quick comment on that is I hardly agree with you there, Grant. You do believe that some of the UFO researchers are attempting to subcontract their research in this field to the solely scientific domain, whereas mainstream science and academia definitely hesitate to deal with such a non-traditional subject. Excellent points made in that article and your other work. Now, Grant, I have to ask two questions here coming in from the room. Again, they're excellent from our researchers. Now, I haven't forgotten you, Skymon. You're coming up right now. But just before that, we have our archaeologist and historian, Mark, wondering if you have obtained any interesting research as to UFOs appearing in such periods of U.S. history as the Civil War, for example. Is there any UFO mentioned in the Grant or McKinley libraries in Ohio since they were both involved in wars?
Okay, I spent a lot of time doing that, which is another thing that you sort of, when you take a good look, you have to learn a lesson from it. And it does seem to back up the fact that the UFO phenomenon, people say it's been going on for forever and ever, but it certainly does seem to have really started in the Roosevelt administration. Before Roosevelt, there's really nothing. There's only two exceptions, and they are both with the same, it's, I'm not sure whether it's Jefferson or Jackson. I'm not sure which the president was. It was 1812 and 1814. There was letters written on UFOs. And I think I have one on the website. The second one we were checking with the Philosophical Society, where the document is in Philadelphia. And I haven't run the check yet to see whether there's a legitimate document. The second one is really a UFO document, talking about an object in the sky. And so there's two, I think it's 1812 and 1814. One of them's on my website. Those are the only ones. I for example, I knew that Lincoln during the Civil War was very much into ghosts, and his, you know, they had all sorts of seances of this, and there was a number of presidents who were into paranormal phenomena, ghosts and that kind of stuff, and especially channeling, or first ladies were into channeling and stuff like this, or having seances and stuff, but I didn't really find any UFO stuff. Only that one situation, 1812, 1814, there's two documents, historic documents. Other than that, there is really nothing. And anybody who has a document, I will have it up on my website right away, because I have spent a lot of time looking and really have not seen anything. And I think if there had been something else, somebody would have come across it. I think we would have seen. I spent a lot of time searching, but so far no luck. And unfortunately, I can't remember the name of the president who was there in 1812. But it's those two documents are pretty clear that somebody's seeing something in the sky.
Oh, that's a wonderfully detailed answer there. Thank you, Grant. Now we have a question coming in from another favorite researcher here, Skymon. He is mentioning that you had written a piece about the alleged black and white video of a captured gray alien. Do you think this is a hoax, or what did you find out about it?
I think it's a hoax. It's kind of a long story. I'll just tell a short, brief part. Mm-hmm. The way it first came up, it was fairly interesting looking documentary or a piece of film, and all I made was a comment on Facebook, and I said, well, you know, if this is a hoax, they're getting better at this kind of stuff. I mean, this was like, some hoaxes are pretty blatant. And then it started to take off, and people started to get involved in it and trying to track it down. And it got tracked back to a person in claimed to be from Sweden, a woman from Sweden. And so I contacted her, and it turned out it was this is the weird part of the story. It turned out it was a guy who had been involved in a South African crash. In the book UFOs, MJ-12, and the Government, we had dealt, in the first draft, we dealt with the South African crash, and there had been a guy who had provided the documents and claiming there was a crash in South Africa who had had a sex change and had become a woman. I found out that this person in Switzerland who I talked to was the same person who was this guy who had provided the UFO documents about back in South Africa in 1989. I immediately said, this is a hoax. I mean, this is bad news. And at that point, I dropped the film, and this person blocked me from Facebook and pulled all their stuff down. And I'm pretty sure it's a hoax, especially it's connected to somebody else many years ago who was a man at that time. And that case was very interesting, but probably a hoax as well. I can't believe people do this. I can't figure out why you would pull this off and then play these little games. To me, it doesn't make any sense. Like, I don't know what joy they get out of it, but it seems to me like kind of a pointless exercise. But there are people who do this kind of stuff, who put film clips out. And in fact, after the black and white film that the question is talking about, there was a couple others from coming through the same channel, and you can't really tell where they're coming from. It's hard to, because people can sort of make up an identity. There was a couple others, and they were pretty interesting as well. Some of these, the quality of the hoaxes, which puts us in a position now where literally nothing that comes out in video now can be seen as valid, because it's so easy to hoax this stuff, and it's done a great disservice. But video and stuff like that, I really have started to stay clear of. And this is one example of, I spent a lot of time, wasted a lot of time, and once I tracked it back down to this person, I just dropped it right there and said, man, I could have been doing some, and there was a pile of people who were helping me as well. I think Angela was involved. There was a bunch of people involved, and we all spun our wheels and wasted a bunch of time, going after this thing. And, video is a very, very suspect medium in the UFO community right now. I don't think you can really trust any of it.
Well said. Well said, Grant. And you're to be commended for your research efforts regardless. The subject is certainly a valid one. And, you know, Grant, I think your research and books are vital to confirming to the public that the UFOs are truly a valid subject of consideration. Your book on UFOs, J-12, and the government contains really stunning research results as to these field aspects. It notes key individuals whose accounts and careers prove keen government interest in UFOs, and also the utilization of important American and Canadian scientists and other personnel in government studies of UFOs.
Yeah, it was a time, this is in the late 80s when we put the book. T. Scott Crane, who was at Penn State University, and I put this book together, and it was one of those times in, you spend a lot of time. I actually had a period of about, say, 8 or 9 years where I actually pulled frustrated, that I actually pulled out and then got back in and sort of got in deeper than I ever was before. But you have periods of time, and this was one of those periods of time where literally everything went right. I mean, you know, every sort of piece fit together, and what it had started was, I'd had my sightings back in 75, and I'd gone to investigate what the Canadian government was doing, and that, in the early 80s, a document was released when the guy that ran the Canadian government's research, his files were released. One of those documents pointed to this Dr. Robert Sarbacher, who you had in your introduction, and it was like weird how suddenly we found out who the Canadians were talking to at the Canadian Embassy in Washington, D.C. Official documents marked secret. We found a top secret document, the only real legitimate top secret document, which says flying saucers exist. It's the most highly classified subject in the United States. And the fact that Vannevar Bush and a small group in the United States are trying. And so we had that. And then suddenly the Sarbacher thing came up. And Stanton Friedman tracks down this Sarbacher guy who's providing the Canadians with this information. And he happens to still be alive in 1983. And he tells Stanton Friedman, yeah, well, I got this information. There was a crash and of a flying saucer in the western United States, and there was these briefings at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, and all these scientists went, and I didn't go because I was working up on the Dew Line in Canada for running a bunch of engineers, and I didn't go. And she starts naming off all these top scientists who had gone to this meeting, And then, I mean, it just snowballed. It was just like everything went right. One of the people that he identified, we couldn't figure who it was, a researcher in California, identified the guy as Dr. Eric Walker, who was the president of Penn State University from 1956 to 1971. He was a long time. He was the president at this Ivy League engineering college. And he phones him up, and this guy who's got 14 honorary doctorate degrees and a doctorate in engineering and was friends with President Eisenhower, was appointed as president at Penn State by Eisenhower's brother, who was the president before him at Penn State, and all these different things. And he gets phoned up and he says, yeah, I was at the briefing, so what? And it was like, wow. I mean, just nothing went wrong. And then I ran a bunch of researchers from around the world, different people, into confronting people with questions and stuff. And a lot of people said, oh, I can get him to talk. I said, okay, here's his phone number, here he is. And for a period of 8 years, researchers from Canada, from Britain, from Germany, from the United States, everybody went to this Dr. Eric Walker and got this guy to tell what he knew. And Walker was a guy who really didn't want to talk about it, but he would answer letters and he would talk in rhymes and riddles, and he would try to answer a question with a question. He couldn't hang up the phone. And so for 8 years we collected material on this guy who was chairman of the board of the most powerful military think tank in the United States. And we put all the stuff together, and when it came right down to it, I said to Scott, I said, okay, I think we finished. He's not going to talk anymore. Nobody can get anything. He's sort of quieting down. Let's just put it out. And he said, well, let's edit it. And I said, no, let's just put what we've got. Don't edit anything. And some of the stuff made it look like he was crazy, and some of it was questionable. I said, let's just put everything that he told us, all the letters answered, exactly what happened for 8 years, and we put it all out. And we thought we'd broken the UFO cover-up. I was sure when we put this book out, because Walker was an extremely powerful guy. He was Assistant Secretary of Defense in the United States. His who's who was like 415 words in Who's Who in America. He was a very, very powerful guy. And we had all this. We had tapes. We had all this record, his handwriting. We had the whole thing. We documented for 8 years. And he couldn't hang up the phone. And then what happened was at Penn State University, the reporter who was given the story to go and confront Walker on this thing was, I guess, a junior reporter. And I remember the setup went, and she went to talk to him, and Scott Crane phoned me back and said, well, he hung up the phone on her. He'd never hung up the phone on anybody. And he just said, I deny everything that's in the book, and I'm busy, and hung up the phone. And I said to Scott Crane, I said, well, is she going back? What's going to happen now? And he said, no, she's not going back. They were so petrified of this guy, how powerful he was. He was president emeritus at the time, that nobody would interview this guy for a second time and confront him on the issue. And the thing died. And that's when I pulled out of ufology for 8 years. I figured, this is a total waste of time. We had it. We had the evidence. We had a reporter. We had a guy who had been there in 1947, who knew Vannevar Bush, von Neumann, everybody, all the people, all the MJ-12 people. He knew how it all fit together. He confirmed that MJ-12 existed. The whole thing, we had him on the record, and we could get him, the reporters, to inundate him with questions, get him to break down, give us the real answer, and his credibility would run this story into disclosure. And nobody would talk to him. They were so petrified of how powerful this guy was. The story just died. And that's when I quit ufology. I said, this is a total waste of time. Nobody's going to touch this thing. And I pulled out of the UFO thing for at least 9 years. And then I got back in it. But I was so frustrated by producing this book, UFOs, MJ-12, and the Government, and having the evidence that I thought would break the UFO cover-up, and nobody could care less. I couldn't believe it. And that's what's happened. A lot of really good stories come out. Whether you're talking Danny Sheehan's story about seeing the classified blue book files and seeing a crash flying saucer, Danny Sheehan is an incredibly powerful person. The story just goes. I mean, it's like you can have the best evidence available, and then you go to the White House and they say there's no credible evidence. There's piles of credible evidence. And that's where I gave Leslie Kane high marks, that Leslie Kane has got these very highly powerful people and is shoving them in the face of the politicians and saying, these people are not crazy. These are generals. These are high-ranking people, and these people are the credible evidence. But the media won't touch it. And the prime example of that was when the Rockefeller documents came out, Hillary Clinton was running for president. And in the Rockefeller documents, there's 1,000 pages, and there's two documents that clearly, absolutely clearly show that Hillary Clinton was in the loop, that the material from Rockefeller going to the science advisor for the president was going through Hillary's office, and that the stuff from the science advisor to Rockefeller was going through Hillary's office. Everything was going through Hillary's office, and that she helped to edit a document on UFO disclosure to the president, President Clinton. We know this. The documents, there's no question about the validity of the documents. Her name is there. It's clear what she was. What had happened was I had filed all the Freedom of Information Act requests with the Clinton Library. And the way it works is first come, first serve. So I had filed very early, as soon as the documents became available in January of 2006. 11 of the first 18 FOIAs released by the Clinton Library were UFO documents. And so all the media in the United States suddenly wondered, Hillary's running, why aren't Hillary's files coming out there? What about Whitewater? What about all these scandals? What did she know about Monica Lewinsky? Everybody wanted Hillary's documents, and here the first 11 of the 18 FOIAs came out were UFO documents, UFO stuff about Bill ordering them to put the Science Channel into Camp David. And not to wait. It had to go in by Friday. This whole thing that he had to have the Science Channel. There was some show on Sci-Fi that he wanted to watch. And stories like this. So Fox News contacted me. Associated Press contacted me. Washington Post interviewed me twice for an hour and a quarter. And every one of them, I said, this is why, because it's first come, first serve. These are the documents that Clintons were interested. And here's these documents. And I said, all three, these are major players in the media in the United States. I sent them the Hillary documents. I said, Hillary's running for president. Here are these documents. They're very clear that Hillary was involved in UFO disclosure in 1995, 1996, from 93 to 96, that she was involved, the material was going through her office, and not one of those media would touch the story, even though Hillary Clinton was running for president. And there again, it's the thing that you just sort of bang your head up against the wall and say, you can have the best evidence in the world, and they're not going to touch it. And it gets very, very frustrating. So when I did this article just a couple weeks ago about the congressmen and senators, I went back and I said, let's take a look at everything in UFO history. What has actually worked? What has actually gotten us the farthest? When was the highlights of our stuff? And it's this thing about this, the putting the pressure on a senator and a congressman and keeping the pressure on, that to me, and that's only my guess, that to me is the thing that might actually break this thing wide open. Who knows? Stephen may break it open. Leslie may break it open. There's a bunch of people who are doing what they think is right, and it really doesn't matter. As long as people are doing something. This is an extremely important issue. It sort of touches you for whatever reason you got into it. It touches me because I had sightings, wasn't interested, couldn't care less about UFOs when I first got it until I saw the thing. And then suddenly, it was like my friends went on with their life and I fell off the edge of a cliff into this thing that I've been chasing ever since. So to me, it's important. And to me, it's important that you do something. That is, you're living at an important period in history when this thing is developing, and that you should record what you've done. You can do what you can, and that's like your Angela. I talked and I mentioned at an X conference when I lectured at X conference. These are the kind of things that impress me. Angela Joyner is a reporter. She could have sloughed the story off. She was told, "Leave it alone. You've got other stories to do. Ignore their emails." Ignore it, and she put her job on the line, and she left. She got fired. I said, Angela, when they tell you to put your stuff in a cardboard box and tell you to leave, that's in Canada, that's called getting fired. She got fired for her job, and I said, that, to me, I have the highest respect for, because she stood the line, and it may cause her problems now that she hasn't got money to do stuff and that she hasn't got the job she had before. But I said, you got a daughter and you're going to have grandchildren, great-grandchildren, and 500 years from now, people are going to say, I'm related to that woman who did that. and I'm proud to be a. That's what it comes down to me is that you've got a. We all have this period of time that we're involved, and we should do whatever we can because 500 years from now, this is going to be the biggest story ever, and we had played a part in it.
Very well said, Grant. And Grant, just a few more comments here. I have a wonderful question to you, but just on your book, UFOs. MJ-12 and the government. Fascinating details. I do wonder, I found it fascinating that you mentioned Dr. Wilbert Smith, director of the Canadian Project. That was Project Magnet. May, per his son, actually been shown crashed UFO or recovered material from crashed UFOs as well as alien bodies. Any comments on that?
Yeah, we'd always... What happened there was I'd had the sightings in Manitoba, and one of the people who had seen, my father worked in the same department as Wilbur Smith. And Wilbur, he had a master's, he was a doctorate, but he was the head of communications. He was a major in the Department of Transport. And what guy that had worked for him worked in my father's office. That's how I got the contact. And I went there, and he said to me, he said, well, if you really want to know what's going on with UFOs, you should study Wilbur Smith. That this guy, I mean, he was talking to the aliens that were landing in his backyard, and I go, what? They were what? And he's telling me all this stuff, and I go, like, I got to go see this, man. So I booked a flight to go talk to his wife. He had died in 1962, and this happened in 1977. I went to Ottawa to talk to his wife, and his wife was Secretary of the Speaker of the Senate. So she was fairly high up in the government herself, and she was about to retire and was upset about the French issue in the two languages coming in the government, and she was upset with the government and was ready to talk. It was like a couple days before she retired, and she starts talking to me about AFA and the alien, and this was, like unbelievable. I couldn't believe this weird story of all these interactions. So what I did was I found out who all the inner circle people, because he was a government employee, but he had to do it quietly. He couldn't be very open about the thing. So he had what was called an inner circle of people around him that he worked with. One was in the Air Force, one was in the Navy. He had one in the Defense Research Department and stuff like that. So these people worked with him on these experiments, these anti-gravity experiments and stuff like that, and these contacts with the alien, and just the most bizarre story. And I'm talking to these inside people, and there was a rumor that had come out to these inside people, and none of the inside people would confirm it. And that was that Wilbur Smith had actually been shown a crash flying saucer outside of Washington, D.C. when he'd gone down. And we knew he'd been going because he was in charge of all the radio frequencies, including the military radio frequencies for the Canadian government. So when they were negotiating with the United States for who gets along the border, who gets this FM station, who gets that frequency, AM and the military frequencies and the intelligence frequencies, he would negotiate. So he was going back and forth. We knew that. And the rumor was that he had seen the bodies. So none of the inside people would confirm. The one guy was dying, and he said, leave it alone. It's long history. I'm not going to talk about it. And I couldn't get anybody to confirm it. And then I went to his son, and his oldest son was the guy who hid the files. When Wilbur died, he said, the government's coming to get my files. And sure enough, his wife said, the Americans came, the Russians came, the Canadians came all looking for his files. And this James Smith, who's the oldest son, who was the one who had hidden the files. So he had the files, and then she said the break-in started at the house. They were trying to find these files, and James had them at his house. So I talked to James, and I said, did you ever hear the story? I said, Buck Buchanan, who was one of the inside guys, I said, Buck Buchanan, there was a rumor story that Buck Buchanan said seen the craft. And he said, yeah, that's true. And I said, it's true. I said, did your father tell you that story? He said, yeah. And I said, well, when did he tell you that? He said, near the end of his life, he had cancer of the lower bowel. He was new. He got sicker and sicker. And right at the end, he said, my father knew there's nothing more they could do to touch him. And he said, at that point, he said, here's what's happened. He saw the bodies, and he saw the crafts. And so I said to him about the bodies. I said, well, were they grays? And he said, no, they weren't grays, because there's always this dispute about whether grays only appeared in 1961, Betty Hill. And I always say that there was no grays before then. So I immediately asked them a question, because this is the 1950s. I said, were the bodies grays? And he said, no, my father did not describe them as grays. He described them as little people. And Wilbur, he said in one of his speeches that if they were to be on the street, you wouldn't notice, but I would know who they are. So in implying that they could actually be in among us, and you wouldn't know that they were there. So his son actually confirmed this, and his son is now probably 65, almost 70 years old himself, and he confirmed that, yes, just before, his father confirmed to him that he had seen the bodies in the craft, and he'd always told, the son had always told, in different interviews when he was interviewed, had always told the story about all the material that was coming from the States, that there was all sorts of hardware that was coming from the States that was given to Wilbert to analyze, and that he would get the little pieces and he would send these pieces back, and that he claimed that in the Pentagon there was actually a room in the Pentagon where this UFO hardware was being stored that was coming to him for analysis. So yes, his son did confirm this, and his son is still alive. And Stephen Greer, I think I sent this to Stephen Greer. I think Stephen Greer just interviewed him for the Disclosure Project on this aspect of the fact that his father confirmed to him that as the head of the Canadian government military program into flying saucers, and Wilbur never called them UFOs. He knew it was a scam. He knew that UFOs was to distract people. He always called them flying saucers, flying discs. He never, ever, even though he was the head of the Canadian program, and 1952, UFOs, the term was started, Wilbur never used it. He always called them flying saucers, and confirmed that, yes, he had gotten this material when he was in the United States, that he had the clearance until 1954 when they shut the program down. But before then, he was the top guy. And his wife even told me that the preliminary report on one of his studies had sat on the Prime Minister's desk in Canada for 3 months. And that at the end of that, Wilbur and the Prime Minister of Canada had decided the time wasn't right to release it, and it was kept classified. But here was a guy that his wife told me was in contact with the Prime Minister of Canada on this subject in the early 1950s, and that he dealt with, even though he dealt with Vannevar Bush, who is the key person that's always been identified in the United States as running the UFO program in the United States. Vannevar Bush was a powerful scientist during World War II that was in charge of the atomic bomb program and proximity fuse and radar and all the different developments. It was Vannevar Bush who ran the scientific end of all these programs, and he was given the program for UFOs. And we do have actual documentation from the Canadian Embassy that show that Wilbert sent a report, his estimation of how these things were being propelled based upon the colors that they were showing. Smith had sent a paper to Vannevar Bush. We have the actual documents, but we don't have what Vannevar Bush thought or what happened when it came back. And that document was actually carried for Wilbur Smith to Vannevar Bush by Major Kehoe, who was the head of a major player in UFOs for many years in the United States. This we didn't even know until we saw this document, that Kehoe had actually had contact with Vannevar Bush. So Kehoe would have known that Vannevar Bush was running the UFO program in the United States, and he never made it public. The only time it became public is when we found these documents that were left by Wilbur Smith, because he wanted the information out, so he double copied a lot of these documents and he put them in his files. And he told his wife, "When I die, I don't care what you tell them, you do not give them the files." And she said she burnt them, and then they started looking for the files, and they recovered, and they are actually now at the University of Ottawa, in Ottawa. And anybody can go there, and there's, I don't know how many, 15, 20,000 pages of his material. And it's fascinating material. And he was a believer. He believed that they were here. He believed he was talking to them. He was in contact with many of the contactees of the early 1950s in the United States. He was in contact with all the government people. And it's a fascinating, fascinating story that we told in the book. And then it all fell apart when we figured when we were going to get the publicity. It all hinged on the Eric Walker thing, and nobody would interview Walker from the media, and the book all just fell apart. And MUFON, it was the first book that MUFON published, and it was an internal book, so they only sold 1,000 copies because it was an internal MUFON book. And what we're planning now is Richard Dolan is going to republish the book, and we have upgraded the Area 51 chapter to tell what I think is the whole story of Area 51. We've updated that chapter, updated some of the other material, and we're hoping that this book will be out. Richard Dolan will be publishing it.
Excellent. That's a fine development. about three questions here, Grant, because you've been just so gracious in giving us this information and answering our various questions, all excellent from the room, by the way. I do have a final question from the room, and that would be whether or not you have personally spoken with Ron Pandolfi. I know from your book that Dr. Ron Pandolfi is noted as having a brilliant mind. Is it correct that he was successor to Dr. Christopher Sikkit Green at that desk? Also, is it true that since 1983, liaison for furnishing the White House with important information as to UFOs?
I would say he, I don't know what he's actually giving the White House. What I know is he is, what would you call it, the liaison mm-hmm. to the White House on the UFO subject, because we know that for a fact, because in 1993, when the White House found that Lawrence Rockefeller was coming to the White House and he wanted to talk to the president about disposing of UFOs, they cut him off at the pass by sending him to the office, the science advisor. So when the science advisor, who was Dr. John Gibbons, heard that Rockefeller was coming, I mean, he really didn't have any knowledge of being on UFOs. He called the CIA for a background briefing, and the job was given to Ronald Pandolfi for the UFO thing. Now, Pandolfi scammed the job off on Maccabee because he was in a position where he couldn't give a briefing because the CIA officially isn't involved with UFOs. He can't have the CIA giving a briefing on UFOs if they're not involved. So he gave it to Bruce Maccabee to write the briefing, and Bruce Maccabee produced the briefing, which is just some citizen's opinion of what's going on really is meaning. So we know he was the liaison, that he was the official guy. And Kit Green talks about meeting with three presidents. So it's that sort of interaction that these guys are the guys that interact and either tell the president nothing or actually tell the president to... I for example, I know that Ronald Pandolfi told John Gibbons, the president's science advisor, not to touch the UFO subject. Stay away from it. He knew Rockefeller was coming. He just said, stay away from it. Don't touch it. We know that. Now, as to whether I've had contact with a lot of people who know Pandolfi, who are friends with Pandolfi, and they all defend him, so I really can't say anything bad. They think he's the greatest guy in the world. I had one contact with Ronald Pandolfi. He contacted me. I didn't contact him. And it had to do with the story about Jimmy Carter. Jimmy Carter was the rumor story that was told by Danny Sheehan, which he got from Marcia Smith, who was in the government at the time. Marcia Smith told him the story that when Jimmy Carter was elected, when he got his presidential briefing, the intelligence briefing as president-elect, he had asked for the UFO files. Now, the briefing for the president-elect is done by the former CIA director. The former CIA director was George Bush Sr. So Sr.'s giving Carter the briefing. Carter asks for the UFO documents, and Bush says, you're not cleared to know. I can't tell you. Apparently, well, he did get fired. He fired Bush. So the story came out, and I put it on my website that the CIA director had told the president, you don't have a need to know, and I'm not going to tell you. Ronald Pandolfi sent me an email. It's kind of hard to explain. He sent me an email from himself to himself, which basically describes this story, and then puts a little note on top of the email and says, here's something that you can use for your website, and basically said, it's impossible that the CIA director would tell the president to get lost. People should use their mind or, you know, think clearly and quit the garbage, or something to this effect. It's denying the story that Bush would have ever told the president, I'm not going to tell you. And he sent me and said, you can put it on your website. And I didn't really know at that time who this guy was. And I didn't find it till about 9 months ago. I found this I couldn't believe it. I had this email from Ronald Pandolfi. But I've had very close contacts with people who know him, Bruce McAbee is a friend of his. Bill LaParle told me a lot of stuff, and then later on Bill LaParle said, you know, I've said things I shouldn't have said. I think he got in some sort of trouble. He basically told me a lot of stuff about him and the interaction with the Clintons. And the other guy, the main guy, is Dan Smith, who has had over 1,000 conversations with Ronald Pandolfi, who was Ronald Pandolfi's best man at this his recent wedding. He got remarried. And Dan Smith puts a lot of the stuff up. I keep very close tabs on what he says. I think he's basically repeating what Pandolfi is telling him. Pandolfi wants this stuff out for whatever reason, and there's some sort of game going on, close tabs on it. I really can't tell you, except that I think Dan Smith is absolutely telling the truth, what he's being told by Pandolfi, why Pandolfi's telling him all this stuff. For example, Pandolfi in 1991 told him, I'm going to Los Alamos to talk to the aliens. And then later on, we find out that the live alien was rumored to have been at Los Alamos. And Dan Smith phones up Los Alamos and is put on the phone with John Alexander. This is 1991, when to try to confirm this story that Ronald Pandolfi is coming there. It's a very bizarre thing. It deals with this Avery. Don't know everything, but they know more than you and I, because they've had some sort of government job, these Avery people. They've had a government job where they've had some sort of interaction with the UFO phenomena. They're fascinated, and they talk to each other because they have clearances and can trust each other, and they're trying to put the whole thing together the same as you and I. I don't know if Pandolfi knows everything. I just know that in 1993, when the science advisor for the president wanted to know what was going on in UFOs, they went to Ronald Pandolfi for a briefing. That's I know for a fact.
Grant, thank you so much for that detailed response. It was absolutely fascinating. We have, I'm going to ask the producer, and as usual, he's very gracious, if we could just have three more minutes. Number one, I want to mention that not only was UFOs, MJ-12, and the government an excellent read, your book on the Charlie Red Star phenomenon, entitled The Day Aliens Fell to Earth, the story of one of the biggest UFO flaps ever, will always be a memorable book to me. Not only do you relate in excellent, really engaging detail, the accounts of the many witnesses, but also your own research. Apparently, this craft was seen by so many hundreds of people in the Manitoba province. You note from your research clear details, clear markers, clear profiles as to this document, as to this particular craft. Although other craft types were seen, the Charlie Red Star principal craft was really so memorable. You note, quote, that it's seen as, here in quotes, a glowing heart with a slow pulsed heartbeat, end quote, seen by so many. However, some also saw the craft with a white strobe-like appearance. There also were triangles seen at that time, many. You have a farm, the Layman's, with 32 registered horses that went missing. You also have an interesting Charlie Red Star ground light factor. You took several photos. Many people took photos. There was film footage from, I guess, the scene was the first of its kind. Tell us more about this book, and I'll let you finish with that. Please, as much time as you want, Grant. I really appreciated this book.
As I said, when I first saw this object, I figured it was like a lottery where you buy a ticket but you're not going to see anything. When I first saw this thing, I was absolutely floored. I mean, my son's a pilot, my father's a pilot, I was a pilot, but I mean, there was nothing that looked like this. It was just so spectacular, and it was like, it was instantly, I knew this is what, because there had been a before I went out there. And as you mentioned, the CKY film, which is in the book, we tell the whole story about how they surround this thing on the ground. These TV networks are going out there trying to film this thing. And there's people there who are actually taking them, because this thing's coming every night. And they're trying to get this thing, and they've got it on the ground, but they don't get a film, and they come out the next night. And the director from the news, the station says, the media guy says, this is garbage. You guys are on overtime. This is garbage. If you want to go, you can go on your own time. And these guys go out on their own time, and they get this film that Jalen Hynek said was the best nocturnal light film. And what had happened was they had this thing surrounded on the ground just 1 mile north of Carmen, and The guy, he's not even a film cameraman, is sitting there and he's watching this thing glow up and down, glow up and down. He says, well, next time this thing glows up, I'm going to shoot this camera. He's 8 miles away. We know exactly where the object was on the ground because it left radar traces or left radiation. We had people surrounded about a half a mile away who had surrounded this thing, and the thing jumped up in the sky. And this guy, just as it jumped up in the sky, caught it on film. And this thing, what happened was it became a world-famous film. And it lit up the whole horizon. There's three frames. In the first frame, it's on the bottom. It's on the ground 8 miles away. The second frame, it lights up the entire horizon. You can see in this one frame, the entire horizon is lit up. The third frame, this thing is 5,000 feet in the air. In three frames, going at 1/24th of a second, it's at the top. This film comes out. Suddenly, CKY, the big network here, is in a situation where they've filmed this thing. The guy who is not a film cameraman, he was a film editor who had actually shot the thing. He didn't get paid. None of the guys got paid. They're in this box. NBC took the film. Everybody's running around. J.L. Hynek wants a copy of the film. And NASA got a copy of the film. And it becomes this big thing. And they're stuck with this guy. And they gave him $50 and told him to keep his mouth shut, that he wasn't an actual cameraman. So there was these kind of stories, and it was something where I spent 2 years where I went out night after night after night and went through the whole thing of looking at it, and it was sort of a disappointment in terms of the same as the book with UFOs, MJ-12, and the government, that I got the book, and I wrote up this thing, and I went to, you know, to the little kid who was going to shoot a gun at it, a little 7-year-old kid who was, you know, a couple feet away and was so scared that he went to get his father's rifle to shoot this thing. Just bizarre stories, cattle disappearing, and actual people, one after another, that I interviewed and went, spent a year and a half talking to these people around this town, put it all together and figured, well, you know, here we go, this is going to open it up. I was so naive about UFOs, and I tried to get it published, and publishers would read it, but nobody really wanted to publish it. So it was a local issue. I went to the local publisher, and I can still remember the local publisher here, and I'm in a city of 700,000 people, said, Mr. Cameron, you may believe in this kind of stuff. Count me among the unbelievers. And it was like, whoa. It was like end of book. So I've had the book for that many years, all the done, and sort of go to the Canadian government to say, the Canadian government will prove it. And I've always tried to not prove UFOs exist, but to say, this is for real, and I'm going to find out. Somebody's got the answer to this thing. And that's what the Carmen thing did. But the Carmen thing, and even in the last couple of months, there's more and more discoveries all the time. And I think it's in the book, the draft I sent you. In the last couple of months, the main flap of sightings took place from February of 1975 to November of 1975. And when I didn't know for 30 years why it had happened, and when I went back, the main guy who ran the airport told me, you know why they were here? And I said, no. He said, they were here because of the missile silos. The Minuteman III missile silos were 25 miles south along the American border, running down to Grand Forks. So when I was doing research in the last couple of months, I suddenly discovered that the only anti-ballistic missile operational site in the United States that was ever built was built. It was operational from February of 1975 to November of 1975, and it was exactly 80 miles south of Carmen, Manitoba, where the vast majority of these sightings took place. So here we have the Americans building this thing, and they had all sorts of missiles that if the Russians launched, they could shoot the missiles down. It's the only operational site they've ever had in the history of the United States, and it was operational for only those couple of months in 1975, just south of the border. So as to why this little town, because what happened was 1975, 1976, we had hundreds of sightings every night. You could go out there, you could see it all the time. It was flying around. You could see it in 1976, and nobody's had a sighting there since. The main guy who ran the airport was Bob Diemert. I said, Bob, how many sightings did you have in 1975, 1976? He said, 100, about 150. I said, how many since 1976? He said, none. Not a single sighting. It's like they took the drugs out of the water. And I think it has to do with those missile silos, and other people have written about it, but this book really concretely shows that those missiles, because the Vietnam War had just ended in April of 1975, all those missiles had gone on alert. The Americans were nervous, and the UFOs appeared, and I don't think there's any mystery. So even 30 years later or 35 years later after this happened, I'm still learning things about what took place and how it all fits together, and it makes more sense all the time, and it's a fascinating story.
It is a fascinating story, and on a human interest note, I note the reports of Royal Canadian Mounted Police who had witnessed these objects, also government pilots and private pilots who had seen these objects. Are these individuals contacting you personally, Grant? Some of the comments, for example, Lonnie, that young boy who wanted to shoot the UFO, was haunted by the phenomenon. One of the pilots had trouble sleeping. Do any of these people try to contact you now?
No, none of them. It's like they've all gone on with their life. I've gone back to interview that. They haven't contacted me. I just had the one, and I think it's in the book, I had the one where suddenly this case came up where this guy wanted to talk to somebody about Sperling. This thing had moved in 1976 to Sperling, which is about 10 miles away, and this is where all these ground light things appear, these monitors on the ground that we were trying to film with infrared and all this kind of stuff. And when I heard he was put on to me by somebody else, because I don't follow sightings. I don't think it sort of gave up after following these sightings. But this sighting I tracked because this guy had said experiences that he'd had. So where we had all these film, these pictures that we had taken were 2 miles east of Sperling. So I remember I met with this guy, and this happened a couple years ago, and I put it in the book. It was the only time that I've really had a witness come to me after, and he said he had these experiences, these bizarre experiences, and owls, burning owls, and all the abduction type stuff. And he was telling me this whole story and wrote it up for me and all this sort of stuff. And I said to him, whereabouts did you live in Sperling? And he said, east of Sperling. I said, how many miles east of Sperling? He said, 2 miles. And I said, 2 miles. That's exactly where we were. We were on the south side of the highway, the main highway that ran through. He was on the north side of the highway, and he was having all these abduction experiences. And we were on the south side of the highway. 30 years later, this guy comes up, and it just sent shivers up my spine that we spent so many nights on this road, 2 miles east of Sperling. And then this guy comes 30 years later with all these abduction experiences from a farm 2 miles east, but 1 mile north of the highway. And other than that, these people have gone on with their lives. Even my friends who were with me, I had a number of people who were with me. I would take people out like a tour guide and show them these things. And people, these people would look at it and they would say, very interesting. Or I'd talk to somebody in a restaurant with one of these people, and somebody would say, well, you were at the sighting? I didn't know you were with Grant when this happened. And the person would say, yeah, I was there. And what do you think? Well, whatever Grant's saying. The other people really weren't affected the way I was. I was absolutely floored when I saw it. The first night I saw it, and I convinced all my friends to go out 2 nights later, and the second night the thing flew right at us. And I was absolutely floored. I was like, I couldn't believe that nobody was doing anything about this. This whole town is seeing this thing. Why is nobody investigating? Why isn't anybody talking to anybody? To me it's equivalent to falling off the earth. It was just like my life ended. I was quit university. All I could think about was these things I had seen. It was just so bizarre. So when people say, oh, it was a plane, it was like, give your head a shake. I mean, it was like nothing you've ever seen before. It was just so bizarre. And the things these things were doing were so bizarre. It really affected me, and I've always seen it as an opportunity that I feel extremely lucky. I've always wanted to have psychic experiences or near-death experiences, because that was my interest before, was near-death experiences and life after death and stuff. I've never had any sort of paranormal psychic experiences or anything like that, but I've had the UFO experience, and I cherish those moments of having seen this, because I haven't seen anything since 1976, and to me it was an opportunity. It was, and more and more I look at it, the more I think it was not chance that I went there. It's something written that I was to be there to see this, and I believe that more. I can't prove it, but I think more and more as I go along that this was not an accident, that I ended up there, and that I was so heavily affected by this, and that all these things have sort of fit together. So I pushed, and I figure something may happen at the end, that this may not all be chance, that there may be some degree of fate, that this is part of some plan to do something to expose this.
Well, you know, perhaps the first source, the creator, wanted you to be an expert researcher and reporter in this field, and you definitely are. So I believe you've accomplished a personal move in spades very, very well. Grant, I hope so much you'll be a return guest.
Yeah. And I enjoy it.
I learn so much when I have the honor of interviewing you. And, of course, Grant Cameron's website is at www.presidentialufo.com. Check out also his excellent articles at that blog site. Now, Grant, what is it, whiteHouseUFOblogspot.com? Excellent articles there as well. And, I hope you'll be returning very, very soon to the program. Everyone, thanks so much for your wonderful questions, too, in the room. I love it when my researchers help me with these excellent questions. And, again, Grant, I so appreciated reading your two books, The Day the Aliens Fell to Earth, the story of one of the biggest UFO flaps ever, about the Manitoba sightings there from 75, 76, I guess into 77, and also your UFOs, MJ-12, and government book. Thank you again. Thanks, everybody. Have a great weekend. Patrice Sheridan, host. Thanks for listening to this evening's program with guest Grant Cameron. Your time with us is appreciated. Great weekend.
That happened after that conversation that you sat there and listened to them. Did anything strange take place in your life shortly after that?
Within a week, the agent that I, he wasn't an agent, the man that worked for the FBI that I had dated, his boss, about two times over, called me. And I had talked to him previously, and I had thought it was kind of odd.